we don't quit long races because of pain, right? With the obvious exclusions if you break your leg or something, sure. right? But we don't quit long races because of pain. We quit because of fear, right? When you're at mile 45 and you feel that pain in each step and you think, I still have 55 miles left to go, okay? And then you let fear compress all of that and stack that tremendous weight on top of you, mm-hmm. and you try to carry 55 miles worth of pain in a step, you can't do it.
Right.
And so you quit. But if you just take the pain of each step as it comes, right, you always have the strength, you always have the courage to take the next step.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, welcome everybody. It is so good to be with you today. And before we get started, I want to ask you a favor. If you enjoy Made to Advance, please do me a favor and rate and review our podcast. Why? Because it helps us get the word out to more people, and that is a big deal. It also helps us bring on more great guests like the one we have today. Kyle Zunker is here with me in the studio. Kyle is a successful attorney, an endurance athlete, and was a diehard atheist before giving his life to Christ. Kyle's written a new book. It's called Amazing Courage, Letters to My Father on Conquering Fear Through Faith. And it records the correspondence between him and his dad when his dad was going through cancer. And through that story and also his own personal experiences, Kyle beautifully unpacks transformative principles on how to overcome fear. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm happy to be here.
So when I first read an article that we were just talking about, I read an article in a magazine that you kind of was detailing your journey. And I was like, oh man, it'd be fun to have a conversation about faith. And then I got your book and I start reading about all this crazy endurance athlete stuff. And I'm like, I don't know, this guy might be too nuts to talk to. At first I'm like, okay, there's a good faith journey here that'd be fun to talk about. When you think of all the endurance kind of races or competitions you've done, what's the nuttiest or most demanding one?
Well, that's a toss-up between 200-mile runs that I've done. One of them is called the Leadville Trail 100. It's a relatively famous race in the ultra-running community. It takes place in Leadville, Colorado. It's a 50-mile out and back, and it's called the Race Across the Sky because the vast majority of it takes place over 10,000 feet in altitude.
Yeah,
that was a really transformative experience for me, and definitely one of the more significant endurance events that I've done. And the other one is much less well known. It's another 100-mile run, and it happens just outside of Houston in August. And it's
Oh my gosh, you are crazier than I even thought. Who does that?
It's called, well, not many people, but it's called the Habanero 100.
Okay.
Couldn't be more different than Leadville. It's totally flat. Instead of the mountains, you're running on sandy trails on a ranch in South Central Texas. The year that I did it, which was 2023, record-breaking heat in Texas that summer.
What kind of temperature are we talking about?
We peaked at 107 before heat index
You're running 100 miles?
100 miles.
In 107-degree temperature?
Yes.
You are fully crazy. Get that all the time. People are like, what are you doing?
If you don't like asking or being asked the question, why, then don't do an ultra-endurance athlete.
There's a dude on our staff that runs like 50s, I think. I don't know if he's – I have to ask him now if he's done hundreds, but he's definitely done some 50s. And the guy that's in the next office over is debating if he's going to do a 50. So I said you're going to be here if you wanted to pick your brain on training. And he's like, I've got to run into a meeting. So, you've got to really have a lead-up on this to be ready, huh?
Yeah, I hired a coach for my first 50, which is what I started with. I had actually never run a marathon before. Okay. I was a sprinter in high school. You know, a 5K was a long run for me. Mm-hmm. And just got this idea in my head of the 50-mile run on my 30th birthday. And my wife, who's, you know, a lot more practical minded than me on these sorts of things, she was like, yeah, you need a coach because you have no idea what you're doing, right? Yeah. And so I hired this wonderful coach, Coach Brandy in San Antonio, and she guided me through the first 50. She also coached me up to the first 100, which was the Leadville one. And then I self I had a couple of young kids, and so I had limited time. I couldn't do a proper training regimen for the habanero, and I didn't want to disappoint my coach every day, so I just self-trained for that one.
Okay, gotcha.
But I kind of had a good basis from years of working with Coach Brandy on it.
Did you, when you were doing the Colorado one, did you, as some do when they're not training in Colorado or at high altitude, they'll wear the oxygen mask thing and train at home? Did you do any of that with them?
That's so funny. So I was living in New Orleans at the time. As soon as I decided to do that run, my wife and I moved from San Antonio to New Orleans, not because of the run, just she had a career opportunity and I was able to work remote. So we headed out there. So now I'm training for this run that takes place in cold, thin air at 10,000 feet of elevation, and our house is 6 feet above sea level, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, New Orleans couldn't be a more different world than the Rocky Mountains. I mean, it's just, there's literally no elevation change. It's it's pancake flat, it's hot, it's humid. And so I was thinking to myself, like, how am I gonna adjust to this? Well, this is before our first son was born, and I actually moved up to a nearby town close to Leadville and lived there for 21 days leading up to the race. So I did an extended Airbnb rental and tried to acclimate. I think it helped, but at the end of the day, it was just getting through it. Because man, it was just a different world, and my heart rate did not adjust very well, but I found a way to get through it.
Yeah.
So maybe I should have worn a mask, but no, that's the way I went about it.
I don't know. We were training for, we did a big trek, me and a bunch of guys, through the Himalayas. And, so we were on this long trek and obviously quite at altitude.
Yeah.
And one guy really worked the mask ahead of time. And he did great, but it was all, I would say, all younger-ish and very in-shape guys. So I don't think anybody struggled from the actual terrain, even though it was rough. What we struggled from was the food, which I'll tell you what, that was to do that. I mean, that level of distance, and it was constant up and downs, even though I thought it was going to be more downs than what we had because we helicoptered in. But it was nonstop ups and downs. But man, I don't know if it was the food we were eating at the different places or a few of the guys tried to be real culturally relevant and drank unpasteurized yak milk. And yak would be the key word there because for the next number of days, I mean, it was just guys who were so strong and so healthy. We'd take a break and they would just lay on the ground and look up at the sky. And I remember walking up to this one guy whose name is also Brian. I said, "Brian, brother, how you doing?" And I mean, the dude is tough. Literally, he's like on the ground, tears just start coming out of his eyes. He just spontaneously starts crying because he's so, you know, wiped from this whole experience.
Well, that sounds pretty similar to 100 Milers because you can have, you know, you've got all the time in the world to plan what food you're going to eat. The races, typically in 100 mile races, have tons of options at the aid stations of food, including they'll be cooking up like some mashed potatoes or quesadillas or whatever if you want to get something more substantive. But inevitably, for me at least, and I, from what I've heard from other people, it's pretty common. I mean, you just hit a point where the ability to consume calories is just so difficult.
Yeah.
Like, and sometimes it just impossible for solids, right? And I've been there before. And so you're just taking whatever. I mean, it's funny because at Leadville, I ate a really strict diet leading up to it. I didn't consume any sugar for like 8 months leading up to the race, just trying to really reduce inflammation in my joints as I was doing these long miles. The race comes, I can't stomach any of the food that I brought with me. And I ate about 40 of those s'more flavored sugar pouches of gel.
Kidding.
That's what got me through. I mean, just you can't predict it. And nutrition on those long events is tough.
Yeah.
You know, and so I can
get it done though.
I didn't drink unpasteurized yak milk, that's for sure.
Well, keep it in your pouch or something for next time. You know, that's the secret. As long as you don't have to do it over multiple days. We're all good on the first day.
Right.
It's just on the subsequent days, or I should say starting that evening. That's when that's when we met reality. So, well, you've got a really cool story, and I would love to just spend some time talking about your faith journey, and maybe we could start by you just giving me a bit of a snapshot on like what were matters of faith and church attendance and engagement like for you growing up?
Yeah, so I grew up in an amazing family, hit the natural lottery there, had a very loving and supportive mom and dad. With regard to faith, I would say we were more than CEO Christians, but yeah, less than regular attendees.
Yeah.
That's the church Easter and one other. Yeah. You know, and we didn't really talk that much about faith, mm-hmm, in the home. Again, like very loving, very supportive parents, and I grew up in a family culture where, you know, a loving family, academics and athletics were really the focus, mm-hmm, from my perspective as a kid growing up, yeah, in our family. So nominally Christian, but didn't really have a really well-developed or firm faith, I don't, yeah, think.
So you get to college and you've got some sort of cultural Christian heritage, we'll call it. And then you get to college and you're in your first kind of place where a lot of maybe these assumptions you grew up with are getting challenged and new ideas are coming. Talk to me about your journey once you hit college.
Yeah, so in college, I think it was the first time that I started thinking really seriously about what I'll call metaphysical questions or, mm-hmm, issues. You know, where did we all come from? This sort of stereotypical, you know, the big questions, yeah, in life. Sure. And I found myself drawn to a lot of writers and thinkers who were from the atheist or skeptical camps, mm-hmm, because their presentation of arguments was a lot more, they appealed to reason more, mm-hmm, I'll say. In at least that was the perception that I had, right? Was that these atheist and skeptical philosophers and thinkers and sort of social critics were appealing to rational-based arguments and things that I really impressed me, really drew me in. And I had the conception, which I now firmly believe is a misconception, but at the time I had the conception that the atheists and the skeptics were operating from, you know, a higher level of enlightenment,
okay,
and speaking from reason, whereas the people who were talking within the faith community were really just reciting things that was like this kind of dogmatic recitation of ideas, but they really didn't have an explanation for it, mm-hmm, and that's kind of what happened to me in college, and it was not this phenomenon that I sometimes hear other Christians talk about of like, oh, the big bad professor is going to like take your college student, yeah, and like lead them astray or something. That was not my experience at all. I had wonderful professors in college, but it was just there's ideas out in the world, and I'm glad that I learned about them.
Yeah,
I really am, because ultimately where I'm at now, I think is a much stronger faith than I ever would have had but for those experiences. But because I came into it without having really done a lot of heavy lifting, mm-hmm, theologically or from a faith building standpoint, I was, you know, so impressionable as to these other ideas.
Right. Yeah, it's funny from a pastor's perspective. I'm always thinking about how do we help come alongside like high school students get enough of an undergirding to their faith that they really thought it through, such that when they get to let's say college or whatever they do next, and they're asking maybe some bigger questions, they've got a faith that's been built on a firmer foundation and maybe have some background in apologetics, things like that. But the tough thing is, if you're in high school and you're not yet wrestling with those questions, you don't necessarily have like a felt need to do the work that it takes. And then, but if you get to college and you get hit with all these questions, and there's not anybody around, and we'll kind of get to the, you know, how your story develops, but if there's not anybody around who can walk with you in those hard questions, who's also a believer and who's thought through things from a more reasoned perspective, that's when you can get into a bit of a tricky spot. So now, what's interesting is you're going through this time where you're really getting skeptical towards the faith that you grew up with, but then you also start really wrestling with some anxiety and panic attacks. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I think that those things are related. But I was probably 19 years old, maybe sophomore year in college, when I had my first panic attack, which for anyone who hasn't had one, it's so difficult to explain in language that makes any sense, right? Or is comprehensible. Because, you know, at first, when you're first having a panic attack, you're just very scared and confused about what's going on. Almost ubiquitously, everyone who experiences a panic attack for the first time thinks that they're having a physical life emergency, mm-hmm. a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, because that's just your perception of it, right? It's amazing the physiological response that your body does to a panic attack, right? Mm-hmm. So, things are physically happening, right? You're shaking, your heart's racing, you're flushed, your face is red, or whatever it is. So at first you think it's a physical, condition. And then moving forward from there, as you start to figure out, oh, these are panic attacks and you're working through them. One of the things that happened to me was I started to panic about having panic attacks.
Interesting.
Right. And so that was really, over the course of years, that's where I ended up, which was a very dark spot, because when you fear.
Yeah.
You're in a rough spot, right? Because I would have panic attacks. At first they were triggered by sort of stressful situations, right? But eventually, I would start to have panic attacks just because the situation I was in was one where it would be really unfortunate to have a panic attack. Because then, as you're going into that situation, right, you're now panicked, like, oh, this would be a really bad spot to have a panic attack because there's no clear way out, or I don't have my medication on me, or whatever it might be. And so that was a really rough spot.
How many panic, like how often would they come, would you say?
At first they were linked to sort of stressor situations. And I would say that, once a month or so is how often it was happening. And then I started to develop like a general prevalent anxiety level, right? So panic attacks are sort of isolated episodic events, but the general anxiety then started to come in, which is just like, it's here, and it's going to just hang out, for years. And it's not as debilitating as the panic attacks, right? But it's just constantly there. And I think at my worst, I was probably constantly with that level of anxiety and having panic attacks, of different severity, like on a weekly basis, I would say.
Yeah, that's significant. And this whole time, when you're really wrestling with pretty significant, severe anxiety, are you thinking much about faith, God, ultimate things, all that, or are you pretty resolute in no, I'm not buying all of that?
Well, I would say the answer is both. Uh-huh. I was a philosophy major, as one of my majors in college, and I was still very actively involved in sort of the thought process on these important questions, but I was firmly in the camp of an atheistic worldview. Mm-hmm. So, believing that, this is a materialistic, exclusively world, and there is no God, and, that's just the way that this is. But exploring those questions and writing about it in school in a very heavy way. Mm-hmm. This is not just like a casual thought, once a month or something like that. It's something I was actively engaged in.
Did you ever have a moment where you're having a panic attack? And I mean, this is sort of like classic foxhole kind of situation, where you're like, God, if you're out there and you take this away, or not so much?
Well, I mean, I think ultimately something akin to that when I was 26 and I gave my life to Christ, but in the really dark part of my life, I honestly don't recall that kind of foxhole moment ever coming up. I mean, I think I was just in such a panic and had departed from faith or relationship with God so much that really didn't I wasn't there yet.
Okay. Well, that's a great segue into just kind of talk about how did you end up then in a journey back to faith? How did some of this like intellectual fortitude on, I'm not buying it, start to melt and turn into something different?
Yeah, I think so. Life came first, right? I think the lived experience worked in tandem with some of the intellectual arguments and ideas, hearing some counterpoints, that helped. But I think really I had to, because I was so convinced in the atheism, I had to kind of be worn down mm-hmm. and whittled down a little bit, right? And so after 6-7 years of you know, varying severity of having anxiety and panic attacks, I eventually got to a place where I was just completely physically, emotionally exhausted, right? And I want to say something else about anxiety and panic attacks. Like, I feel like if someone is listening to this and they don't know me, they're going to think, oh, well, this person must have been like locked up in a room, never going outside, not doing anything, like because they're struggling so bad. I was in college and law school during this time, and I graduated with honors and whatever from both college and law school through this process. Mm-hmm. And one of the misconceptions, I think, is that people think, oh, well, if you're externally having whatever objective measures of success, then everything's just totally good in your life. But I felt very much like I had like this secret part of me that was suffering, right? And it's internal. I mean, I've got tons of friends. I have a great girlfriend at the time. You know, I'm going through law school, and yet there's this part of me that's kind of locked away and is suffering. And I feel like that part became more and more of me over that time of mm-hmm. that period of time, right?
Did the people around you know that there was this part of you that, I mean, on the outside, what I hear you saying is on the outside, everything's up and to the right, it's going great, kind of living the dream. But you know you're facing an inner battle. Do people like your girlfriend or other friends know it? Or are you really like, man, I'm keeping this button down. I'm not going to let anybody know that I've got this whole other battle I'm fighting.
Yeah, very few people, I think, knew. My mom did, and she's very supportive. And my girlfriend did, and she's also very supportive. But, you know, I'm talking to them about it at my most desperate moments, right? Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, but I'm not, you know, coming to them every time that I'm struggling with anything,
sure.
Right?
Sure. So when you mentioned earlier that there were, so you're, on the one hand, you're wearing down with all of this battle with anxiety, which is sort of perhaps, I think what you're saying is maybe setting the way for considering faith in a different way, because you're not so strong and like resolute, right? Just internally, physically even. But you also mentioned that during that time, you've got some folks maybe pushing in on some of your assumptions. Who were those people? What are they saying? Is this like books they're giving you? Or are these conversations? Are they people of faith or are they not? How does all that work?
Yeah, it was a church. So my wife and I started going to a church in downtown San Antonio. We had walked past it hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times. We'd been living downtown for a long time, and it was right next to this area in San Antonio called the Pearl, which was like the epicenter of urban revitalization and hip stuff going on in San Antonio, right? So we live in that area. We have this like great apartment down there, and so we're always at the restaurants and the coffee shop and the bar and the farmer's market and everything down there. And I knew that my girlfriend, who right around this time became my fiance, and I knew that she had a stronger faith aspect of her life, right? Mm-hmm. And I suspected that she wanted to carry that into and grow it as, you know, the rest of her life. And I thought, well, look, I want to sort of like score the points as the good husband. So like, I'm going to start going to church. I've got no intention of believing anything. I'm coming into the door very armed with my conceptions about like, oh, this is going to be just social club. It's going to be all about like new music. And it's going to not really have any substance to it. It's just kind of a club, you know, and it's one that's maybe important to be a part of, socially, but I'm not going to actually believe anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's we started going at the end of 2015, and I remember the very first message that the pastor said that day. It was about in Genesis, God's call to Abraham to sacrifice his son. And as soon as he started preaching about that, I was stunned because I thought, this is one of the passages of scripture that I most often cited as an atheist talking to people of like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to, you believe in this God that's going to ask someone to sacrifice his own son. Like, and ultimately he doesn't do it, but why would he put him through that experience? Like there's just some sort of sick test that he put him through. Mm-hmm. And so I'm coming into this church and immediately, you know, the very first thing I hear is a direct attack on one of the things that I relied on as an atheist.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of jarring. You know, and what the pastor said that night made a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. That really was like a pivotal moment. I was definitely not converted right then, right? Yeah. But it jarred me. And I realized walking away, it's like, okay, I haven't given this a fair analysis or a fair approach, right? I've been considering that everyone who's against faith has all of the rationality and the arguments that are supported by logic. And I've been considering that faith is just a bunch of people who are just picking this to believe in it for the sake of picking it. And what I heard that night challenged that assumption and opened me up to starting to think about things more deeply.
It's really, really cool that, I mean, that this, obviously the pastor was willing to take on a hard text. You can't, I mean, if you're any pastor worth being a pastor, you're going to take on that text. You've got to come at it with a really well thought through approach because that is a really important, really difficult text. And I think it has, fits that category for a long time. So it's cool though, that that's the thing that basically God uses to kind of put a little crack in your foundation. The thing that, and I love your book and we'll come back to that later, but one of the things you talk about in the book is it's like you were rejecting faith and rejecting some of what you grew up with, but you're the first one to say you really didn't probably have the level of foundation set that you were rejecting something. You kind of had a straw man, a little bit of faith.
Yes.
And you were rejecting a straw man where you had some of the best possible folks representing other views outside of faith. And so all of a sudden, it feels like this is an open door now where you're starting to get something more than a straw man that's representing. Now, how did the journey progress from there? I'm guessing you guys went back to church.
Yeah, so we kept attending that. It was a 6 p.m. service on Sundays, Pearl Street Church there in San Antonio. Yeah. And we kept going to the 6 p.m. service. I was still guarded. I was still skeptical of everything, including all of the people in there, right? But we kept going and kept being welcomed just with the biggest like smiles and enthusiasm by everyone on staff and there, which is a whole other topic of how I think successful ministry works with people who are outside of faith. But we kept going there. And in the meantime, I'm sort of now trying to wrestle with things with this more intellectually honest approach. Because that's one thing that, you know, I think I've been mistaken at certain points in my life, but I don't think I've ever been intellectually dishonest, or at least I've never tried to be, right? And so when I walked away from that first night, I was like, you know what? I really need to look more into this. Yeah. So I read the New Testament first, and I don't know why I started there as opposed to the beginning and the old, but I think I had heard somewhere like, if you should read the New Testament first and then go back and read the whole Bible all the way through. If for nothing else, it's much shorter, right? So I read the New Testament first.
What was your reaction? Had you read the New Testament before much or not?
Not cover to cover.
Yeah. So you'd had some familiarity with the Bible growing up. But
I knew the Easter story, right? Yeah. The story preached on Easter. I knew the Christmas story of the incarnation and the birth. But, you know, and some of the parables. But cover to cover, no. I had never. And my reaction to that was like, oh, there's a lot of interesting stuff here, but it was, you know, standing alone, first time reading through it, a little bit difficult to take it all in, right? So in the meantime, I'm supplementing it, and I'm reading different what different people have to say within the camp of faith, right? And then I ended up coming across, and the timing of this is hard for me to remember specifically what happened first, but at some point, within a few months after starting to go to church, I came across the writings of someone that like changed my life, and that's C.S. Lewis.
Oh yeah.
And I'm pretty sure the first thing I read was Mere Christianity.
Good place to start.
Yeah, good place to start. Setting aside the Bible, it's the most important book to me. And as soon as I read that, I don't want to come across as narcissistic, but I was like, he wrote this for me.
Mm.
I have never felt a more kindred spirit with someone intellectually, mm-hmm. or, you know, from a thought process,
mm-hmm.
than when I read that book. And I just read everything he's ever written. Like, I went on a tear. Everything. Yeah. I still have some of his fiction work on my to-do list. But
same. I tried, and then I was like, man, I really am not a science fiction guy. Yeah. This is rough.
Yeah. So, everything nonfiction that I've been able to find in publication, I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I read Tim Keller I could list a list of names for the rest of the podcast, which I won't do, but it went from there. But C.S. Lewis was really the thing that changed my approach on a philosophical level, mm-hmm. to the questions about faith that I had been struggling through. I mean, his writings and how sort of common sense they are, but yet they're underpinned by such like rich thought,
right.
really helped open me up to what God was doing in me.
It's funny because I read a book years back now called Faith in the Halls of Power, I believe was its title. And essentially the author goes through different spheres of society, business, the arts, maybe some government, I forget. But he talks to leaders and influencers in each one of these different fields who are Christians. And he did these extensive interviews. Some of the folks were willing to be quoted by name and all that. Others, because of their position within their companies, felt like it would be better to not let all of the details they were willing to share come out by name and in public. But here's the thing that was interesting to me. He said, hands down, the number two themes that were clear for all these folks who had come to faith and were now in fairly influential positions. He said most of them had come to faith later in life, so they weren't raised in the church, all that, grew up as followers of Jesus. For some it was college, grad school, or even in their job. But the second thing was the hands down number one book referenced by many of them was Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, bringing them to faith, and that came up over and over again. So it's a good, besides your book, which we'll talk about, that's a good plug for, besides getting amazing courage, get Mere Christianity if you're listening, and it will encourage you. So how long then did it take before, when you finally said, okay, I'm going to give my life to Jesus, was it like, you know, just kind of this slow journey, and then one day you woke up and said, you know what? I think Jesus is who he said is, or was it like this big moment, or what happened?
To the best of my memory, it was April of 2016, maybe 4 months after we started attending church together, my wife and I, or she's now my wife. And it was another sleepless night. I was in bed. I think it was 2 a.m., woke up. Pretty typical night for me that I've got, you know, anxiety, I can't sleep, my legs are buzzing and tingling and twitching, and one of the things I would typically do is I'd put on my workout clothes and my shoes, and I would go to the complex's treadmill, mm-hmm. and I would just walk for like an hour in the middle of the night just to burn up some of that excess energy to try to be able to go back mm-hmm. to sleep. Well, on this night, I just, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, I had just reached a point where I was so just tired of this feeling this way in this process. And I went, we had a concrete floor in our loft. I took out a yoga mat, spread it down on the ground, and just laid down on the ground and prayed. And it was the first time I had prayed since, I don't know, I was 18, I don't know. And the only thing I could think of was, thy will be done. So I just prayed that over and over, those four words, for however long it took. And then started to pray a little bit more as I was getting the strength to do it, and just said something along the lines of, like, look, this whole process that I've been going through, all this anxiety, all this fear, thy will be done in my life. Like, whatever it is, if I'm going to die tomorrow, you know, thy will be done. And it's really hard to say that and mean it. It, even now, as someone who's been following Christ for 8 years, 9 years, whatever, that's still hard to do on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But in that moment, it was a very genuine prayer that I said, and I experienced something that night that I didn't know how to describe it until I read it later in Philippians 4, when it's the peace of God that surpasses all human understanding. Mm-hmm. Because what I felt that night, I couldn't describe. It was like, you've carried years of worry and anxiety and fear, and in a moment, it's not that all of it went away, mm-hmm. but in a moment, you're suddenly able to handle all of it and have peace, like in an instant. And that was just a very transformative experience. And, you know, so we kept going to church. I had actually already been baptized when I was in high school.
Okay.
You know, we got baptized by my grandfather at a church service in South Houston when I was in high school. But the next time in church, I did the profession at the end, you know.
Okay, gotcha.
Every head bowed and every eye closed.
So when you had that evening where you're sitting there and you go, "Thy will be done," and you started to experience peace right then, did you have a notion of, like, "Oh my gosh, my panic issues may be over," or were you just like, "I know something's different, but I don't know what this is going to mean for my anxiety," and what ultimately did it mean? I mean, was it like, just like that, you're not dealing with major panic and anxiety issues anymore, or was it, how did it play out?
So I was very, well, in that particular moment that night, I don't really even think that I had cognizable thoughts that much, as just like this receiving this peace and mm-hmm. just being thankful for it and submitting to God's will. But, you know, shortly after that, moving forward, I was definitely ecstatic about the idea of being done with anxiety and panic attacks and fear, and had a noticeable different level of that. One of the things that post conversion to Christianity or reconversion that I had to learn the hard way was, you know, when I accepted Christ, I thought, okay, I know that this doesn't mean I will never have external challenges or difficulties, right? Because that's not what the gospel is. But I thought, okay, now internally, I'm gonna be squared away now. Like, I'll carry this internal peace and fortitude and courage, and I'll be able to walk with Christ in that to take whatever these external challenges are. And I quickly learned, like, that's not the case, right? Yeah. And that was a hard lesson to learn, a really hard lesson to learn, because that, you know, that I'll call it a high, right? The high of communion with God and of finding faith lasted for however long it was, until, like, oh, this is a walk of faith, this is a journey.
Yeah.
For me, there's still doubts. There's still, you know, I think I'm hardwired to be prone to anxiety and fear. So that has not gone away. Mm-hmm. Now my life is radically different now. I feel like I have a tremendous amount more of peace and tools and mindset approach to that. But it certainly hasn't, you know, been like a light on, light off
totally
switch.
Yeah. I think your journey is, I mean, really, as I'm sure you've had conversations, really, really common as far as, putting your trust in Jesus, sensing progress and growth in some very important areas, but also not having it be, oh, it turns out that massive issue that I was wrestling with is just all gone. Now, that does happen. I celebrate when people have that. I've talked to people that were literally, you know, addicted to drugs and tried so many times to get clean and failed and failed and failed. And then they gave their lives to Christ. And it's just, boom, whatever their drug of choice was just sounded terrible to them. Never touched it again. Bless God when that happens. That's fantastic. But it doesn't, sometimes it still takes a little bit of time to work out. Did you were taking some medication for panic attacks. Did you end up continuing with medication or not so much?
Well, that is one thing that does fit into that category you're describing. I haven't taken anxiety medication since that night. And I think that I have been able to rely on the peace of God rather than having the medication. And I want to be really clear. That does not mean that that's the appropriate journey for everyone. Right. And I don't want anyone listening to this to feel any shame for seeking medical help. In my book, you know, I have a little paragraph where I encourage people, you know, don't suffer alone, don't suffer in silence. Like, get pastor's help, get a doctor's help, start building your life to give you a better shot of peace, right? Mm-hmm. Getting more sleep, cleaning up your diet, getting more physically active. So these are all, medicine is one of, in my mind, one of the tools in a comprehensive program. But my honest testimony is I haven't taken any since that night. And I think that that was just a healing that that God gave me.
Were there any particular books or thinkers that were helpful for you, particularly on the subject of fear and anxiety that you were reading at that time? Or was it mostly just generally you were reading specifically around faith and what it means to follow Christ? And then the byproduct of that was greater peace. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. So if I butcher this, then we'll have to clean it up. But I believe it's Max Lucado has a book called Anxious for Nothing, which is really just an exposition of Philippians 4 and that sort of foundational passage about, you know, be anxious for nothing, instead pray about everything and experience the peace of God. That was a book that stands out in my mind as being important. But, you know, I have to say, I think really scripture and just general books about building up faith sort of took care of the heavy lifting there. Like, I didn't so much need a book that was specifically talking about how to deal with anxiety as I did need books that are strengthening up my faith, which is kind of ironic because I wrote a book about conquering fear through faith.
Yeah.
But I think the reason I ended up writing that book is because I didn't read this book, right? I sort of like lived that process as I was going through kind of faith formation and kind of distilling some things down. So I think it was sort of a mix of everything I was reading. Yeah. The one specific one on anxiety is the Max Lucado book.
That makes sense. You and I, not that I've talked about this so far, but we have a lot of overlaps relative to some anxiety, fear issues. And then I would say I am constitutionally wired to ask questions and to doubt. And so it's funny, both in college and even in seminary, I was just, I mean, battling. And I came across a book called God in the Dark by Oz Guinness. And he goes through these different, what he calls species of doubt. And it was like such an eye-opener for me because most doubt presents as intellectual doubt. It's really, I'm thinking these thoughts, I have these questions, etc. But part of what he digs into in his book is sometimes what's presenting as intellectual doubt is actually stemming from emotional life stuff. And the moment he said that, now I did have some other species of doubt, but I would say one of the primary ones for me was this category of doubt that comes from, as he calls it, unruly emotions. And so I started digging into that subject and at the same time read a book called If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat by John Ortberg. And it was basically, when Peter walks on water, but this whole idea of dealing with fear. And between Oz Guinness's book and John's book and the footnotes. I'm a big footnote guy, man. You put a footnote in there and it's off of a good quote. I am all over it. So I picked up a couple more books and I just realized, man, I have got to figure out how to deal with my fear and my anxiety. And so a big part of it though was because my faith was so unformed and not built on great foundation. So one, I had to put a good foundation in place, but then two, even with that foundation, I had to develop some tools to deal with fear and anxiety because it felt like no matter how solid I knew my whys of faith, like the why of why I believed what I did, once my emotions spun up, it felt like my whole foundation just disappeared out of mm-hmm. nowhere. And that's where I realized this doesn't make sense. There's something going on here that's deeper than just like beliefs and doubts.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And some of my most painful and sharpest moments of doubt now come in the form of that emotional doubt. And the way that they present in my mind normally is something along the lines of, oh, come on, this possibly can't be true,
yeah.
Right? This is just kind of absurd. You've led yourself astray. And it's like, that's not even an argument at all, right? Mm-hmm. That's just an emotional mm-hmm. or that's just an emotion-driven thought that comes to your mind. It's not based on any sort of reason. And when I stop and realize that, I'm like, okay, that's just an emotional-driven thought. Let's go back to, one, the sort of rational basis that I have built for myself through scripture, through other writers, and through my thoughts on it. And then two, or maybe in the other order, my lived experiences mm-hmm. with Christ, right? And it's like, okay, that this doubt of like, oh, this can't possibly be true. That's really not a rational or an intellectual doubt.
Right.
It's just something that, you know, whether it's an attack from the enemy or you just want to call it like an emotional urge or something, it's not a like an intellectual doubt as you referenced.
Yeah. Well, it is funny. I mean, at the end of the day, Christian faith makes massive claims. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were just talking about this the other day, because here I am. I mean, I followed Jesus for a long time. I pastor church, all this stuff. And I'm still like, my goodness, these are just huge claims that we believe. And the thing that she and I were talking about is, on the one hand, you could make an argument for they're so big, so grandiose. Just the very nature of the incarnation, stop there.
Right.
God becoming flesh, that is insane mm-hmm. to think about. I mean, it just still, all these years later, blows my mind. So on the one hand, like, there is a logical basis to go, that's pretty crazy. The thing is that, and this is back to the whole like triggering our reason, it's crazy until it happens. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of God being God, there is going to be nothing else that fits into that category. I mean, he is the definition of a one-off. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like, there's the moment we're talking about something as big as a cosmic creator, there are going to be things that just seem very cosmic, very difficult to get our arms around. The trouble is, and this is where, you know, again, thinking through the other side, if you're going, yeah, it's just too much for me to believe. Well, now you've got to deal with all the other flip side things. Okay, so how did existence come to be? Why do we have things? Where do morals come from? Why do we believe good and bad? You know, where does love come from? Is it just biology? And so you've got problems all the way around.
How do we have free will?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, so it's not like there's one option where you go, oh, well, this is the no faith, easy belief kind of clear path. Talk for a second about, sometimes people get locked into, I think, a mentality of, I need 100% confidence. I need 100% belief. And that's pretty tricky. So I don't know if you've thought about that much, that idea of what level of confidence. Have you processed that?
Truman, well, I don't know if I have the objectively correct answer for everyone, but I've thought about it a ton. Mm-hmm. That was a huge point for me as an atheist considering Christianity. And, you know, I think it went through kind of a three-phased evolution. So at first, as an atheist, I'm sort of thinking, look, the default position is atheism, and I need someone that has to prove to me until I'm 100% certain of God, one, and then beyond that, Christianity or the God of the Bible, in order for me to step out, right? Because I'm sitting in the default, and you have the burden of proof, and that burden is a certainty. Okay, well, that I think that's clearly wrong, right?
Well, and the funny thing is we almost hold nothing in our entire lives to that standard, but with this area, people do tend to kind of drift that direction.
Could not agree with you more. I mean, I could talk about what you just said for hours, especially as a lawyer, right, who tries cases for a living, right?
Yeah.
But I think I got rid of that relatively quickly because that's just, I mean, I think that's pretty obviously incorrect if anyone stops to think about it for just a second. But then I was in kind of a second evolutionary phase of my thought process about like knowledge, faith, certainty, and doubt, which was okay. So let's say then now the default position is I'm just sort of undecided. Maybe you use the term agnostic, but I'm just kind of like this uninterested, dispassionate, unbiased observer, like stepped out of this equation, and I'm just going to like stack up evidence and see which way it goes. Not unlike, you know, a calculator, you punch in some numbers, you hit equals. You don't get mad at the calculator for what it says.
Right.
That's just my brain crunching stuff, and I don't have any control over that. That's a involuntary product of computation, right? Mm-hmm. And I felt like that for a long time. And my whole thought process was I found the evidence wanting, right? I find that it's insufficient for faith. What percentage was I requiring? Well, that's, you know, there's no clear answer. Some certainly more than 50% in my mind, right? And probably I was requiring a lot more if I was giving it a fair shake.
Sure.
But, you know, where I ended up, what I firmly believe now, for a variety of reasons, one of which is scriptural, is that both of those two models are incorrect. Really, it just takes any faith. Right? 1% is sufficient, right? If you have 1% faith, then you have enough faith to take a step of faith in Christ, to accept the invitation into God's kingdom, and to start walking in faith. And I'm not telling people, like, if you genuinely look at things and you genuinely don't believe, I'm not saying you should pretend that you believe, because
sure,
that's not actual faith, and that's not going to be productive for you. But I think it's Mark 9. There's the passage of the father of the child says, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Those six words were radically transformative for me. Like, maybe the most important six words in the Bible for me as an atheist, because I thought, okay, that is really astounding. Mm-hmm. Like, the first three words, I believe. The second three words, help my unbelief. Okay,
right.
So you're sitting in a position of unbelief, but yet you're able at the same time to ask Christ to help you believe. And his child's healed, right? So it's also a sufficient faith, apparently,
right,
according to the text. And that blew my mind, because I thought, okay, that's where I got rid of that second model of understanding of knowledge, faith, what's required. There's just 1% that's required in order to make the decision, the choice to reach out to Christ. He did it literally in person, right? And we do it literally in spirit, right? But it's just 1% required to reach out, and that's all you need.
Yeah.
And I think it was Timothy Keller said something like, the virtue of faith is not in the strength of your faith, but in the strength of the one who you have faith in, right? Yeah. And so that's the thing is, we have to do very little of the work. Like, we have to do the accepting, right? And having faith. But it doesn't require 100% certainty.
Right.
One last thing on this topic. The presence of doubt, you know, after I accepted Christ and I still had doubts, whether they be intellectual or emotional, as we were discussing, I was really troubled by that, you know, because I thought like, oh, once I accept faith, like I'm not going to be more doubts and I'm just going to be on this walk of faith. But I still had doubts, and I came to realize like that a doubt is a very poor reason to give up faith, because, you know, I don't want to get too, you know, into the weeds here, but, you know, I think of faith as having twofold, right? Faith as trust in God, right? So once you've come to belief, you're trusting him in his plans. But then there's this sort of preliminary faith as belief in God. And when it comes to that belief aspect, having doubts is a very illogical reason to give up faith, because faith can only exist in the presence of doubts, right? I mean, if we have no doubts, if we're 100% certain about something, right, we don't have faith, not in the sense of belief, right? We just have knowledge, right? Like if someone asked me, do you believe in your wife? I'm like, well, if you're asking if I believe that she exists, like I don't have it. I know she exists. I live with her, right?
You're not having to tap a deep well of faith,
right,
because she's sitting right in front of you.
And so, so if we're talking about the belief aspect of faith in God, you know, a doubt is like, we should expect it. Like it by definition, there is room for doubt if there's faith, right? Yeah. And that has been something that now it's still painful and troubling when you have doubts, and it's still something you have to work through, but it doesn't rattle me or scare me as much, because I'm like, yeah, this is to be expected.
Totally. Right? Well, and anybody who's honest, no matter what their worldview or philosophical presupposition, will be willing to acknowledge there ultimately is some level of faith required regardless of your worldview. No matter what your first principles are, there are the most ultimate things about any of our views we cannot prove. There is a leap no matter what. It's you know, you've got to wrestle through where does the evidence best point you. But I totally, and not only are doubts not a problem, and doubts are part of the faith process, but I feel like my experience has been when I chase down my doubts and really ask, where are these coming from? If handled well, and I've seen this so many other people's lives as well, doubt handled well, I've seen actually lead to greater, deeper faith, because it's forced me to ask questions I wouldn't have otherwise asked. It forces me to do work and have conversations. And all of a sudden, I come out the other side and my faith is actually stronger and more robust having had the doubt. So I always want to encourage people not to run from doubts, not to be scared from them, you know, scared of them, not to think your faith is terrible because you have doubts and serious questions. What I want you to be scared of, in a sense, is letting those linger and like hiding them under the rug and not dealing with them, because then over time, I think you can actually end up eroding your faith.
I agree wholeheartedly. And I would say, even if you have that doubt and you look it in the eyes, right? And a lot of what I tell people through the book and when I'm speaking is, you know, the first step to conquering fear is call out fear. Because, man, fear loves to operate in shadows and in this sort of like mysterious dark cloud where you can't really see what's going on. So the first step is like call it out. So if I've got a doubt, I want to like squarely address it, right? I'm a writer, so I might write out my doubt so I can see it in clearly expressed terms, and then chase after it. And what I've learned is, you know, if I can resolve it and show that the logic or whatever it is against that doubt, great. Even if I can't, right? Okay, here's this doubt. Maybe someone you know, raise the question about, well, how, if the Bible says this and it says that, like, what does this mean? I'm like, oh, that's good. Kind of tricky. And I run it down and I ultimately don't have an answer for it. Okay. Now I've explored it. Like I've seen the challenge there. It's not this amorphous, like boogeyman in the closet anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's a doubt that I have. Okay. But that doubt gets partnered up with all of the reasons for faith that I have.
Right on.
And that's just a part of my overall like spiritual journey or whatever you want to call it, my worldview. It's like, yeah, I've got unanswered questions here and there. I've given them due consideration. I've run them down. I don't have a clear answer. I've got a couple of maybes, but I don't know. So that factors in along with all of my reasons for having faith.
Good. Yeah. That's so good. And I think that's such a great encouragement to anyone listening. You know, it's really about the sum total of the weight of the whys, the weight of the evidence we have for faith. We may have some doubts, some questions, some even things we consider objections, but just because you have a question or an objection or an unanswered question, well, that doesn't mean, oh my gosh, well, how could I continue following Jesus then? It just means I've got to take all these things in total and weigh them. I remember I had this list of issues with the Old Testament. I mean, there's some very challenging material in the Old Testament. I'm reading these authors trying to deal with these problem passages, and you know, the brightest and the best. I had went to an incredible seminary with you know, globally known professors, and I'm asking them these questions and feeling like, well, that was not an awesome answer. But I remember one day, this is all these Old Testament issues I'm dealing with. I remember one day reading a book by Philip Yancey. I forget the title of it now, but he made this very simple point. The Old Testament was Jesus Christ's Bible. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hold on here. I know I'm okay with Jesus and I know why I am. Somehow Jesus was able to make peace with the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. He understood things, no doubt, that I don't understand, whatever. But if Jesus can like be faithful to the text and faithful to the Father with the Old Testament as his Bible, then I probably can too.
Right.
And it was just, and I still, some of those same questions, still have them, still don't have answers, still wish, man, it'd be nicer, God, if that wasn't in the Bible, but it is. And yeah. I'm fine with it, you know?
No, I think that's really good because there's fundamentally at least two ways you could try to sit down and do a ground up kind of philosophical argument for Christianity, right? You could start in the sort of abstract theoretical of like, oh, like let's logically prove God exists. And then like, let's somehow tie that into the Old Testament and like move in a lineal fashion forward. Or, right, you can start with the historical reality of Jesus and investigate that and look into whether or not you believe in his deity. And then to your point, if so, well, then that's got massive dominoes that fall in either direction.
Yeah.
And so fundamentally, two different ways you can approach it, and they're not mutually exclusive, right? Like you can look at both as having faith, but I think oftentimes people overlook the second, right? Like if you, like it's a really earth-shattering thing if you believe that Jesus Christ was a historical person, which well more than half the people on earth believe that, including practitioners of Islam, right? That they believe that Jesus Christ was a historical person. And so if you take that, and then if you go to the next step of believing that, you know, the accounts of miracles are correct and that he was the Son of God, like that's earth shattering. I mean, like everything else falls in line because of those two things.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think you're right. There are a million different ways to start wrestling with faith. But selfishly, if I was coaching someone, I'd say, start with Jesus. start with Jesus and start, you know, working it out from there. It's funny, after all of these years, C.S. Lewis's old point on Lord Liar or Lunatic,
yep.
I still come back to that because sometimes Jesus is saying something and I'm wrestling with it. And I just think, oh man, this is so demanding or so stretching. And still I'm like, but who do I take Jesus to be? Right. I mean, was he crazy? You know, is the kind of the lunatic side of things. Right. Was he lying? This is just a bunch of stuff even he knew wasn't true. Or does he have something to say? And I keep coming back to him. Yeah, I think he has something to say. Now, this has been, I want to make sure we talk about your book. Okay. It's so good. And this has been such a good conversation about faith. And it is, of course, related to your book. And I know many are going to be encouraged because every time I talk about faith and doubt, people are like, oh, thank you, because that's where a lot of folks live. But again, the book's called Amazing Courage, Letters to My Father on Conquering Fear Through Faith. And it is a beautiful book. It's so personally, winsomely written. Each chapter starts with a letter that you wrote to your dad. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And then after that letter to your dad, then each one of those is so beautiful in and of themselves, you proceed often to talk about a personal story from your own life and then begin to unpack some of the learnings and principles that come from that story. So overall, it's a very accessible, very readable, very encouraging book. And what I love about it is, on the one hand, there's very much a connection at the heart level, but it's not like this book's all heart and feelings. There's just really good content and argumentation to it. So overall, just a really well-written, well-balanced book. Tell me what was the genesis of, hey, I need to put this in print. I need to turn this into something.
Well, let me start by thanking you for the kind words. I appreciate that. You know, after my conversion to Christianity, I wanted to write something about that aspect of it, right? The sort of the intellectual basis for it. And I started installed, I don't know how many times, mm-hmm. to write that book. And I had a lot of, one, I was still processing a lot and still developing a lot of my understandings and thoughts. So it was probably a little premature. But two, I had a lot of what people call imposter syndrome, right? And I'm like, I'm not a good enough person to write about faith. Mm-hmm. I don't have the credibility. I'm not a pastor. I didn't go to seminary. I've lived the life that I've lived, which has included X, Y, and Z. And I just don't think that people are going to want to hear what I have to say about faith. So it was a lot of fear of mm-hmm. following through in that writing that was, as fear almost always is, it was because I was a lot very me focused of like, how are people going to perceive me if I try to write this and things. And so, I stalled and stopped a bunch of times writing some ideas about faith. Then in 2019, I got the phone call from my dad that he had esophageal cancer. And I vividly remember the moment. It's the start of the book. And it just like everything stopped. And it was the first time I had heard fear in my dad's voice in the 29 years that I had known him. And I immediately started writing him letters to encourage him. And in that moment, I stopped thinking about me so much, right? And I had an audience, a one-person audience, mm-hmm. right, that I was writing to about faith. And I was completely liberated from all of my fear about writing about faith and putting myself out there by my greater concern for my dad, right? And so I think one of the things about faith, and this Bible talks so often about those who fear God and fearing God, and it's the source of all wisdom. And I mean, there's, I don't know how many times those words appear, but it's a lot. And my experience has been that the fear of God was very liberating because it allowed me to escape my fears of other things, mm-hmm. right? So it's like the healthy fear, if mm-hmm. you will, right? And people have different interpretations of what that means. It's like a deep reverence for God and things, but for my lived perspective and experience with writing this book, fearing God and fearing that I was going to miss my calling and my opportunity to help his kingdom and to help my dad liberated me from all of my other fears. So I wrote those letters to him. And then, after his battle with cancer, I was sitting on these letters, these 18 letters that I had written him. And I thought, let me put these into some type of a book. The 18 letters stacked together wouldn't have made but a pamphlet. So yeah. I had to add some things, but I had a lot I wanted to share and add also. And so I did it in the fashion of writing these little memoir stories, which I really don't like calling the book a memoir because it makes it sound like a me more, like it's all about me. But I really don't view it that way. I mean, I really think it's, it's about faith and the lessons that I learned about faith, even at times when I was an atheist, right? And one of the things that I firmly believe in and that I think comes across in the book is God may give us the answer to a question before we've asked it, right? I mean, God exists outside of time. So he may give us the answer when we're 10, to a question that we ask when we're 29, mm-hmm. right? And so that's really when I sat down and I paired up each letter with a story of what I've learned about faith and how it's helped me. That's the aspect I was tying into of like, yeah. this is here's something that I want to share about faith. It's related to whatever I was talking to my dad about in that letter. And they're not in chronological order because it's not a biography or a true memoir, right? It's really, the subject is faith, and I just happen to be a character in the book.
What's cool is as you're going through your journey with anxiety and fear and tying that to how you're encouraging your dad, you really start feeling as a reader, man, I want to be the kind of person who overcomes fear. I don't want to let anxiety and fear have the last word in my life. There's a quote that is from the book that I really appreciated. You talked about fear is a fraud who robs us of today with threats about tomorrow. And I would love for you just to expand a little bit on that for the person who might be listening. And yeah, they deal with some fear, and sure, they might not be tackling it head on, but you know, they're just kind of tolerating it. What would you say to them by way of encouraging them to start really wrestling with their fear? What are they missing? What's the difference greater faith is going to make?
Fear is a lie. That's the first thing I would tell them. It's something that I learned the very long and hard way. That does not mean fear doesn't exist. It just means it's a lie. It's a fraud, like you read from the quote. And really what that means is fear is nothing in and of itself. It is always an extension or a shadow of something else. So I say it this way in the book and when I'm talking to people is look at a couple examples, right? Fear makes a healthy person sick with anxiety of worrying about the future. Fear makes a wealthy person struggle and stress over finances because of worry about potential collapse in the future. Fear makes people who are longing for companionship withdraw into isolation and ensure that they never find companionship. And it's always the fear of what might come tomorrow, what potential tragedy, or the fear that what you're currently suffering from may never end, or the fear that what you're currently walking through may get worse. Anytime that we allow fear to play that game on us and start making our potential worries and sufferings and tragedies of the future into these big sort of monsters, fear is bringing that pain to us right now. Mm-hmm. Like we are experiencing we are suffering from something that has not happened to us or something that may not continue to happen to us. And that was really an eye-opening revelation for me. I think that there's an analogy I often give people to kind of drive this point home. You know, it ties back to how we started with the ultra endurance running. In a 100-mile race, a lot of people don't make it to the end, right? The average race is probably like 30 or 40% of people finish. But no one stops at mile 99. Like, I've never seen it happen. Yeah. I've never seen someone stop at mile 99. Okay? Well, you haven't slept the longest at mile 99. Your nutrition has been out of whack the longest at mile 99. Your body is the most broken down at mile 99. So you are in objectively the worst physical condition at mile 99. And yet no one stops there. Why? It's because we don't quit long races because of pain, right? With the obvious exclusions if you break your leg or something, sure. Right? But we don't quit long races because of pain. We quit because of fear. Right? When you're at mile 45 and you feel that pain in each step and you think, I still have 55 miles left to go. Okay. And then you let fear compress all of that and stack that tremendous weight on top of you. Mm-hmm. And you try to carry 55 miles worth of pain in a step, you can't do it.
Right.
And so you quit. But if you just take the pain of each step as it comes, right? You always have the strength. You always have the courage to take the next step and only carry with it the pain that that step brings with it. And so that analogy I find helpful when thinking about life, because it's like, what do I have to carry today. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try as hard as I can to not let whatever may happen tomorrow, next week, next year, next decade, come into my day to day in the form of fear and weigh on me. And to wrap it up, faith to me is tremendously helpful. And in my mind, it's really the only true tool against that, because when we grab on to the truth of the gospel, that you know, through salvation, through Christ, everything for us is going to ultimately be redeemed, whether we see when it's going to happen or not, whether we see how it's going to happen or not, if we just trust in that and lock onto that, that is the truth, that is the promise and the tool that makes it possible to start mm-hmm. silencing fear and start saying, no.
Yeah.
You control or you're a threat tomorrow, but right here, right now, I'm grabbing on to the promise at the very yeah. end of the day, and I'm yeah. just going to walk with that.
Man, I love that. It's funny as you're talking, I'm thinking, of course, Jesus' famous words, don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow has enough worries for itself.
Right.
So it's like, on the one hand, Jesus himself is saying, listen, you know, just be present for today, because you don't know what's coming tomorrow. Tomorrow's got its own thing. Could be the best news ever you get tomorrow.
Right.
Could be fear. Don't know. So let's not spend all kinds of real estate in our hearts over to a tomorrow that we can't be sure of. But in a sense, and I haven't thought about it until you're saying it this way, even though generally I'd say that's great wisdom, don't give real estate in your heart to tomorrow, there is a very real sense as Christians that we do want to give real estate in our heart to the ultimate tomorrow, mm-hmm. where we have this confident expectation of new creation. We have this confident expectation of how the story ends, that God does make all things new. And so we might not know whether tomorrow is going to bring a raise or a demotion, but we do know that regardless, the story is going to end well. And so we can place our faith in that. And I think that probably helps us stay a little more rooted on the day to day. I think that's such a great point. Maybe final question. If you're talking to someone right now, or somebody's listening and they're just like, man, I can tell I'm letting fear and anxiety creep into my daily life. I can tell I'm not taking the risks that I would want to take. I'm not living into my dreams. I'm holding back in different ways. What would you say are a couple of key strategies to take steps forward in overcoming fear?
In the book, right at the beginning, for anyone who has a copy, there's a link you can follow to access a free download that contains what I call the 5 C's to conquer fear. And so what I tried to do was take all of these lessons that are communicated in the narrative story fashion in the book and lift them up into a step-by-step framework, right? I think that the most effective way to communicate ideas and to have life changes through stories, which is why that's the way I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. That being said, I know that these types of frameworks are also helpful. Some people like them up front. For other people, it's a nice supplement. And so it's there for anyone who has the book. It's a 5-part framework. C1 is call out fear. So the very first thing I would tell someone is, we talked about it earlier, is you need to acknowledge that very often we think that our problem or our enemy or our struggle is some tangible tragedy or suffering or something. And those are real, don't get me wrong. But it's so magnified and enlarged by fear, and we don't realize that. And so the very first step is call out fear, like bring it out into the light and look it in the eyes and address what it is that's causing you fear. 2 is choose faith. And we spend a lot of time talking about that, but I think that's the only real infallible tool mm-hmm. to conquer faith. And
still good to call it out, because ultimately faith still is a decision. I mean,
right.
it's a good conscious, just like you're consciously calling out fear. Faith is not, I just drift into it or I just kind of right. accidentally fall into it. It is a conscious choice. I will choose to trust.
And it's open to everyone, including people who have doubts, as yeah. we discussed.
Right on.
3 is change your approach. So once you've called out fear, you've chosen faith, you know, and as you know very well as a pastor, that's a lifelong commitment to a journey, right? Yeah. Day by day. And change your approach really means okay, now everything that you are pursuing in your life, all of your desires, all of your worries, they are all immediately relegated to second tier status, right? And second tier is still high up on the list, but it's second. Because first tier is God's will. And so you're changing your approach to life where number one is thy will be done. Everything else is number two or below. That perspective change or change in approach has helped me so much to conquer fear, because if I've got faith in God, then God's will be done. Mm-hmm. God will have his will done. And so if that's my approach, if that's what I'm after, then I'm already good. Yeah. Everything else, now I have some very genuine things that I would like. I would like to have health for myself. I would like for my family to be healthy and well provided for, and et cetera. But even those things, right, are secondary status. Mm-hmm. Four is chase big goals. So I'm a big believer in faith in action. You know, and one of the things from writing my book, one of the big life changes that happened is my faith went from an internal passive thing to an external active thing. And so I was actively writing to someone other than myself and engaging. And I think that when we put our faith into action in pursuit of a big goal, it really helps us to stop falling prey to fear, because you're an easy target if you're just sitting there wallowing in the what ifs mm-hmm. and the fear. Whereas if you're out there, you know, moving forward physically and metaphorically, right, with whatever you're after, you know, you're harder for fear to prey on if you're in motion and faith.
Yeah.
And then five is care for others. And I think that the more we care for other people, the less focused we are in the man or woman in the mirror, the less of a grip fear has over us. So the less focused we are on ourselves, the less of a grip fear has on us. And it's one of the paradoxes of courage, that it takes courage to encourage someone else, but encouraging someone else gives you courage.
Yeah.
That's the last step. And, you know, I'll just wrap up that last point with something I think a lot of Christians don't always ask themselves, which is a really obvious question when you step back and think about it, is who's the best example of courage, right? Was Jesus. And what gave Jesus the courage to do what he did? And it's easy to sort of say, well, like, Jesus is God, so he just got buku courage coming out of him, right? But, you know, when I was like, Jesus was also man, and so what gave him the courage to do it? And I think it's all of those things we've outlined, but really I think it's C5, it's care for others, because Jesus was focused on giving a gift to us, not on himself. It wasn't like, oh, how is my performance going to look in carrying the cross and doing this? It's like, no, he was focused on us. And I think that he is the ultimate example of courage that I want some of that courage, right? Mm-hmm. Like even a fraction of it. And so I think that is, you know, what enabled the ultimate example to be so courageous.
Yeah. Well, that's a great note to end on, and just to really lift up Jesus as our central example of faith and the inspiration for our own faith. I love that idea of continuing, and it is, backing up to your fourth point, it is paradoxical in some ways. Sometimes I think people are waiting for the faith to come before they take the step, and what they don't realize is the faith is going to come after they take the step. Mm-hmm. And when you're first taking steps forward in faith, where you go, it's in a sense you don't feel the faith. It is faith because you're taking the step. But what you find is the more times you take these risks. And I love what you said. I mean, it's particularly when they're risks on behalf of others, then all of a sudden you get on the backside and you're like, whoa, my faith just got stronger because of this. And then it happens again and then again and then again, and then it becomes a pattern you become used to. And each moment of taking a step out in a new direction or exercising your faith becomes just a little bit easier. I hope, you know, this is when I think about the trajectory of my life, I hope I never get to a point where I'm not still taking risks that I want to keep taking risks that are always still challenging my faith, that I'm having to go to new levels and belief for bigger things, because that side of me that wants to continue. I'm not going to be taking the faith to be running 100 miles anytime soon, but that part of me that likes that sense of this is dynamic. It's growing. I'm not just stagnant. I didn't do the one thing that really required faith. I'm going to keep taking those steps, because as you do, then that faith muscle continues to get stronger. And I don't know about you. I found like as my faith gets stronger over time, my overall joy and fulfillment in following Jesus and just life in general continues to grow as well. Would you say that's been the case for you?
Absolutely. I think joy produces happiness and not the other way around.
Yeah, it's good. Well, it's been a fantastic conversation. If folks want to find you, what's the best way to look you up?
The best way is go to kylezunker.com, and there's only like one or two other Kyle Zunkers in the world, but I'm the one with that website. And you can follow everything that I'm doing there. I've got a newsletter you can sign up for where you'll get automatic notifications about blog posts that are coming out.
Cool.
Link to my books available on there also. I am on social, predominantly Instagram, Kyle A. Zunker. One of the other Kyle Zunkers got it before I did. But but that's, I mean, I share some stuff. I'll share, you know, quick little posts about, you know, directing people over to my website. But yeah, if you want to come check out what I'm doing with my family, you can come scope that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, cool. That's the best way.
Cool, man. Well, I just really, really commend the book Amazing Courage to those who are listening. Great job on writing it and taking a step out in your own faith journey, just putting it to print and putting it for all of us, putting out there for all of us to enjoy. Again, for anyone who is specifically dealing with fear, this is a great read. But honestly, there is just by virtue of talking about your relationship with your dad and your family and your overall growing up journey, there's a lot more than just the subject of fear too. I mean, overall, what it means to kind of just spiritually progress is another theme that comes through the whole thing. So anybody who reads it's gonna to be encouraged by it. In fact, I gave it to a friend of mine, and she was reading it to kind of help. She helps out a little bit with our podcast, and she's like, "Man, this is so good." She's like, "Even though she wasn't able to read the whole thing before the podcast, but she said, even though that I've only gotten so far in, she's like, I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm so encouraged by it." So I know that's going to be the case for everybody. So great job with the book, and thanks for coming to Holland, Michigan today for this conversation. Sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. It's been awesome to be here.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kyle about overcoming fear through faith. And I just want to say, if that's your journey right now, if you're wrestling with fear, if you're wrestling with anxiety, trust me, you're talking with someone right now who is a fellow sojourner down that road. I've had many years of dealing with fear and anxiety, and I am so pleased to be able to say that through Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit, God has helped me overcome so much fear in my life. I feel like some days I don't even resemble the person I used to be. And I give credit to God for that, but I only say any of that to give you hope that God can help you overcome fear as you work through some of these principles that Kyle talks about in his book. Hey, if you found this conversation encouraging, if you found it helpful, please do rate and review us. That is such a gift to our podcast. It's been a production of Engedi Church. We've got more incredible guests and incredible conversations on the way. And so until next time, just know you were made to advance.